Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a crime and mafia podcast. I am Jeff Nadeau. Welcome back in. Hope you're enjoying your day. We're back here week two. Week one was great. Really enjoyed doing the show on Vincent Gigante. It was a good success. People liked it. People enjoyed it. We're back here for another episode. They didn't shut us down. We're back. And we got a great topic today. We're going to talk Nicky Scarfo, one of the biggest lunatics in the history of Cosa Nostra and organized crime. We got a great guest to talk to. As always, make sure you subscribe to the show. If you're on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening, make sure you follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Let's get started. As I said, great show last week. Let's follow it up with number two here. Joining the show is a Nicky Scarfo expert. We had to bring him on. I guess he's turned into a bit of a friend. Scott, I would say you're a friend at this point.
Yeah, buddy. I consider you a colleague and a contemporary and someone that I admire in what you do and how you do it. And you got some class, you got flair, you got knowledge. It's the perfect combination.
That voice you're hearing is none other than the great Scott Bernstein, the author of Mafia Prince. I had to get Scott on because Scott wrote the book along with Philip Leonetti on Philip Leonetti's life. If you're aware of the mob, Philip Leonetti was the nephew of Nicky Scarfo. And when I mentioned this to Scott, I kind of assumed we had to get Scott on. Scott's a historian. He's an organized crime expert, does some great work on all sorts of different websites. He's the owner of the Gangster Report, does some great stuff, was a kind of a counsel and a consultant on movies. You're an expert on Detroit Mafia, Scott, right? You did some stuff with White Boy Rick and all sorts of different things.
Yeah, I consider my coverage district. I mean, I'm from the Midwest, grew up in Detroit, spent a lot of time in Chicago, cut my teeth, in the world of learning about organized crime, actually in Chicago, working for the Illinois Attorney General's office in law school, working Chicago mob cases. And that really sparked my interest. This was in the early 2000s and was able to publish my first two books on Detroit and Chicago. And then, George Anastasia has always been kind of the blueprint for how I wanted my career to go. And I called him up when I was in law school and kind of asked him to let me be his protege. And he was always there for me and guiding me. And his writing was very inspiring to me and really was eager to dip into the world of writing about Philly mob, but I had no connections or ties to the city or other than George. But George kind of brought me into the fold and showed me around and introduced me around. And when the opportunity to write Philip's book came up in the early 2010s, it was just a dream come true. And it's my so far in my career, I would say in the first, decade and a half off of the, out of the gate, that's my magnum opus. That's my signature book. I've written six, but that's the one I'm most proud of, and was really excited to be able to tell the story of the Philadelphia mob in the 1980s. And then I kind of used it as a stepping stone or kind of a pole vault, if you will, into writing about modern day Philadelphia stuff. And I love doing it. It's my it's my favorite place to write about. And I love South Philly. I love the Philadelphia area, and I get in there as much as I can. And it's I'm honored to be on here talking about this stuff.
Yeah, obviously, if you know me, I'm from the area. I lived in Philadelphia for many years. I lived in the exact neighborhood that all these guys are from. And go check out the book, Mafia Prince, Inside America's Most Violent Crime Family and the Bloody Fall of Cosa Nostra. And then you can actually also see Scott, big time Scott Bernstein, on White Boy, which is currently on Netflix. The story of White Boy Rick and one of the biggest mischaracterizations of justice in the history of this country. Make sure you go check that out. How about that, Scott? We could see you on screen as well.
Yeah. So I've done a handful of documentaries over the last decade. This one is obviously shot off like a rocket into another galaxy in the last week. it was really in addition to making my bones, if you will, as a crime reporter reporting on organized crime, you know, the Italians, the Italian mafia, here in Detroit, there, and I'm in a lot of other major cities, including Philadelphia, there was a pretty high octane urban drug world that has a real rich history here in Michigan. And one of the most fascinating figures from that urban drug world, opposed to everyone that he was in, you know, in that world with, who was black, Rick was white, and he was a teenager, and he was only 14, 15 years old, and was running around with all the biggest dope bosses in Detroit that were all black and twice his age. And, you know, the scene, if you can picture it, would be like, you know, Superfly driving around in a Mercedes with Leave It to Beaver, you know, in his passenger seat. Well, people didn't really know outside of that very tabloid friendly case that was kind of here and there for a second in the late 1980s and then disappeared because he was in prison. And then I came on the scene in the mid 2000s, started writing about it, and was able to uncover the fact that he was actually a bought and paid for a creation of the U.S. government and had been recruited right out of eighth grade to work for a federal drug task force and put into the Detroit black underworld to infiltrate drug gangs, and was encouraged to drop out of high school. And then when they got all the information from them they could, and they busted the biggest drug boss in Detroit because of the information Rick gave them, they cut him loose. They put him in prison for a traffic stop that he had, you know, ran a stop sign in front of his grandma's house. They found drugs, and because of some crazy laws and some crazy political and police corruption conspiracies, he was doing life in prison without parole until less than a year ago when he walked out of prison. And very proud of telling that story, and worked on the Hollywood film, and the film with Matthew McConaughey came out 3 years ago. Nobody saw it because it was, frankly, it was pretty bad.
I actually liked it. I told you.
Well, I know we talked about it. I'm glad you liked it. Some people liked it. You know, on some of the cable networks, and when it comes on, it gets 3 stars, you know, out of the 4 stars. But I was very disappointed in it. But the documentary, I was incredibly proud of. I worked on both of them. And right now, the documentary is very popular on Netflix. And
yeah.
And I've always known that Netflix was, you know, this great equalizer, and, you know, this probably the most, or one of the most influential pop culture tools that exists in the world today. But I guess until the doc dropped last week and I kind of got propelled into the eye of the storm, I didn't realize you can realize it, and then you really realize it. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, just everything went to another level when that thing took off on Netflix and was trending for a whole week, was in the top. At one point, it was the number 5 watched piece of content on the entire platform.
That
it was heady.
That was how I felt. I remember when I went to Barstool and I created that college basketball podcast. And yep. I remember the first week or two, it was a top 10 podcast on the sports section. And I thought, yep. Wow, this is incredible. I didn't know I had this ability, but yeah, it's definitely cool. You did a great job with it. They did a great job with it. And again, it's definitely not, it's way better than the actual film that they put out, but yeah, go check that out. White Boy on Netflix. But
let me real quick just let the audience know, people that are you know, interested in the Philadelphia mob, there's a slight dovetailing or crossover between the White Boy Rick story and the Philadelphia mob. When Rick was locked up in the 1990s, he was cellmates with Crazy Phil Leonetti and Gino Milano, and they actually were teammates on a prison baseball team and basketball team that won the both won the prison championship like circa 93-92. So
how about that little connection, yeah, right back to Nicky Scarfo in a way. And
yeah,
and you know, insane. Again, you can't talk about Nicky Scarfo without talking about Philip Leonetti, and we'll get into Philip Leonetti just a little bit because he was obviously the protege of Nicky Scarfo. Let's get into it. Nicky Scarfo,
I'd say surrogate son.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get into it. Nicky Scarfo here on the sit down. So a couple of main characters we just have to obviously understand: Nicky Scarfo, Philip Leonetti, Angelo Bruno. Obviously, if you've seen a movie like The Irishman, you know everything about Angelo Bruno. He'll play kind of a part initially in the Scarfo story. Nicky Scarfo, Nicodemo Dominic Scarfo, was born March 8th, 1929 in Brooklyn. And he was born right before the Depression, basically. So we actually have to remember the Roaring Twenties were coming to an end and the Depression was about to begin. Nicky, actually, his father was a mobster. He kind of deserted the family when he was a kid. Nicky's mother decided, well, she's going to move to Philadelphia. She had family in Philadelphia. They moved down to the city. And at 12, they head on down. He kind of worked, did his thing, was still in school. And weirdly enough, Scott, in 1947, when Nicky graduated high school, he was actually voted most talkative in his high school class at Benjamin Franklin High School, which is kind of a weird connection.
If you've studied Nicky, I mean, he's never been someone really to hold his tongue. I mean, no. He was someone that was considerably, I mean, he wasn't like Joey is today in terms of, you know, the media obsession, but there was a media obsession with Nicky, and he did engage with the media and he did engage with the cameras. So, you know,
that doesn't surprise you.
So I could see him back as a teenager being pretty talkative because, you know, I've heard the wiretaps and I've talked to a lot of people that spent time around him. And, you know, there was a lot of stories about him holding court, certain South Philly eateries in Atlantic City, some of the hot spots there, and just kind of having a whole table of soldiers and capos and telling stories and busting balls. And he was someone that, you know, I don't think he wasn't a gaudy. Like I said, he wasn't a gaudy or a Joey, but he was the step right below that.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't, you know, if a camera was near him, he would definitely say something. It wasn't like an Angelo Bruno or somebody like that. It would just kind of fight the camera off. When he came to Philadelphia, obviously he had family here. His uncles, the Piccolo brothers, were in the mob. They were made men in the family. And you know, as a kid, Nicky always was a small guy. He never liked the fact that he was called Little Nicky Scarfo. You never call him that to his face. He was only about, I think, 5'3", 5'4". He was a little guy. He was a little guy.
He would wear lifts.
And that doesn't surprise me. He was a little guy. He hated the nickname, and he actually would fight as a boxer as a young kid. Didn't do real well, so he kind of moved on and joined his uncle, Nicky Buck Piccolo, in the illegal activity trade in South Philly. He bartended, did a little of those kind of things, attended stuff, and came up under a guy called Joe Rugnetta. Joe Rugnetta was a
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead, finish.
No, he was a consigliere in the family under Joe Ida, who was the boss at the time when Nicky was proposed for a membership. Real quick, before we get to your point, Rugnetta was a guy who ran an operation out of a bar on 12th and McKean, right in South Philly. Rugnetta was kind of an old school guy. And as Nicky was coming up, he kind of took Nicky in as a bit of a, not a mentor, but he was around, he was doing things. Rugnetta had a daughter, and I guess Rugnetta said, you know what, Nicky, you seem like a guy I would like my daughter to be around. Nicky kind of shelved the idea and said, no, I have no interest. Your daughter, I don't know if he came out and said she's ugly, but he declined the offer. And that set Rugnetta off. And that's kind of where the first, you know, Nicky kind of always, as we said, never held his tongue. This was kind of the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to undermine your narrative, and I definitely could be wrong here, but the Rugnetta thing definitely happened. Joe Rugnetta was Angelo Bruno's longtime consigliere, and was someone that was upset by Nicky Scarfo's rejection of an offer to marry his daughter, and that actually made Rugnetta want to kill Nicky Scarfo, and he had a that was actually more of a reason that Nicky left town to Atlantic City, more so than the whole famous incident with the stabbing at the Oregon Diner. But I would say I personally would not characterize Rugnetta as any type of mentor.
I think maybe Rugnetta,
I'd say Skinny Razor DeTullio was
sure
was Nikki's mentor, and Nikki worked for Skinny Razor, I think, at the Friendly Lounge, and and then through Skinny Razor was interacting with Rugnetta. But I don't,
and I think that's where I'm kind of going. I think Rugnetta more or less tried to connect, just because if you know anything about Scarfo's background, he's from Calabria. Rugnetta was from Calabria, and I think Nikki didn't really want anything to do with the guy.
Right. So that's like, so. You know, I think Rugnetta wanted to mentor Nikki.
Exactly.
And Nikki didn't want to be mentored by him or upset him to the, or, you know, was kind of did a cost benefit analysis and said, well, I'd rather not be mentored by the consigliere if it means I have to marry his ugly daughter.
Right. Exactly. And at that point, Rugnetta goes, gets furious and basically takes it as a slight. He's embarrassed. He's disrespected. He wants to kill Nikki Scarfo.
He wanted to kill Nikki for it.
Now, again, Nikki had connections. I mean, his uncles were made men. Nikki Buck Piccolo basically says, no, it's not going to happen. But around this time, Nikki's down at the Argan Diner, down on 3rd and Argan, still there today. They got great French onion soup. They're in there. They're eating. I guess Nikki gets to a table that's being occupied. The guy that's occupying the table comes over and says, hey, you know, this is my table. I was just speaking to somebody. Nikki becomes incensed, grabs a butter knife, and basically stabs the guy to death. Now, again, we've all seen knives. We've all seen kitchen knives. It's, I would have to imagine, very difficult to kill someone with a butter knife, but Nikki manages to do so. And somehow Nikki argues that he pleads guilty to manslaughter and that it was self-defense. He gets about 6 months in prison, which is wild. And at that point, as you said, between the Rugnetta stuff and the behavior of Nikki kind of as a hothead, they send him to Atlantic City.
I think it was a situation where he saw it as a benefit to him to go stake out his own territory.
Right.
Where he could kind of start building this kingdom of crime that he had envisioned for himself. From talking to Philip, from talking to a number of FBI agents that worked the Scarfo crew, talking to, you know, the experts that I look up to in the field, I think it's I think there's some mythology that is more myth than fact when it comes to him relocating to Atlantic City. Yes, the situation at the Oregon Diner did not leave him in great standing with Bruno, who was a guy that liked things done quietly and didn't want headlines. And Nikki was, you know, had a hair trigger temper and could go off at the drop of a dime. And yes, the Rugnetta thing also put him in poor standing. But I think I would tell people to be careful with the strict narrative that he was run out of town.
So it was more of less like, and I think I want to kind of real quick set the stage that for anyone that's not from this area, Atlantic City and South Jersey have always been kind of, you know, let's just say at least recently have been Philly territory. I think you're kind of basically you're saying that they wanted to kind of revive the city, because at the time in the 60s, Atlantic City was a dingy, dingy spot. The Atlantic City was popular back in, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, back, you know, in some of the, you know, the early, even like the Nucky Johnson day, those days, not in the 50s and 60s. It was basically a junkie, you know.
It was a junkie's paradise and a dying resort town that nobody really went to as a, you know, like you're saying, back in the 20s and 30s, it was a big vacation spot. It was a ritzy vacation spot where people would go there. You know, people that had money would go there. By the 50s and 60s, it was they were experiencing financial hardships. I think that the place, the boardwalk itself, had become kind of an eyesore. And but all of those factors also make it kind of fertile ground for rackets.
Yeah, I mean, Noam was there at the time, and I think Nikki, in a way, kind of looked at it as such, and that's a great kind of way to put it. In the early 70s, Nikki goes down to Atlantic City, kind of starts up some bookmaking, some loan sharking operations. He was involved in an adult bookstore. weirdly enough, he lived with his family. They lived in Ducktown, a spot in Atlantic City, right at 28 North Georgia Avenue. And house is still there today. It was a big apartment building. His mother owned it, and they lived there. His family.
Started the construction company.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where, you know, obviously Philip, his nephew was, and the whole family was there. And weirdly enough, Nikki's mother, you could kind of tell where Nikki got his personality from, because Nikki's mother, in certain videos that I've seen, you know, she was a hothead in her own right. She didn't take any shit from anybody, which you can kind of tell where Nikki got his fire from.
Yeah, he was very close to it. He was very close to his mom. And in a lot of ways, I think he gravitated towards Philip, and Philip gravitated towards him because they had similar circumstances when they were younger. Philip's father took off. Philip was, you know, I don't want to say a bastard, it's the wrong way to say it, but was, you know, him and his mom were kind of by themselves. And that was Nikki's sister. And, you know, Nikki invited them to live with him and Nikki's mom and Philip's mother's mom, and Nikki became a surrogate father to Philip. At that point, Nikki either didn't have kids or his kids were very young, and Philip became like an appendage, and almost, you know, like if you ever saw Nikki, Philip was right. You know, after Philip graduated high school in the early 70s, from the time he was 18, he was by Nikki's side for the next, 12, 15 years.
Yeah. And he was kind of, as you said, the mainstay next to Nikki all the time. In 71, Nikki meets Nick Caramondi, who was a con man down in Atlantic City, kind of moving rackets and stuff. They kind of kept in touch. They ran some schemes together. And in 1972, this is where it kind of starts to get interesting for Nikki Scarfo. He's hit with, basically tries to arrange a sentence for a cohort of his called Nick Virgilio, who had been convicted in a murder case. Scarfo went to Judge Edward Helfand at the time, gave him basically a bribe of $12,000 to reduce Virgilio's sentence. But again, Virgilio gets 12 years, so basically the judge never did what he said he was going to do. And that's important to remember, because that comes back years later to kind of ostracize Nikki, and Nikki does some things that he shouldn't do. In 1976, obviously, but before we kind of get into the casino boom, in 73, Nikki gets hit with contempt. Him and Angelo Bruno get hit with contempt. Mm-hmm. A group of mobsters basically are asked to come speak to the New Jersey Commission, Crime Commission, about the mob. They all take the fifth and get hit with contempt. They both get sent to Yardville, which is, I don't even think it's around anymore. It was a prison right outside of Philadelphia, right over the bridge in New Jersey. I think he gets hit with 2 years, I want to say.
Yeah, and it was
– go ahead. You can kind of talk about Leonetti. He would go up there and visit.
Yeah, that was really the springboard for Philip. And, you know, he jumped into the deep end of the water. Like I said, he was 18 years old. And instead of going to college, you know, he was getting a master's course in mob leadership. 18 years old. He's 18, 19. He's ferrying – all of the top lieutenants of Angelo Bruno and his uncle from Philadelphia, driving them to meetings, acting as a messenger, taking messages from Nikki Scarfo and Angelo Bruno to the streets of Philadelphia. So, you know, he was inserted as a pretty integral part to the hierarchy of the family right off the bat. And that put him really on the fast track for being groomed to be a leader. And when you become a capo and then eventually an underboss in your 20s and early 30s, in the modern era of the mafia, which let's just say is, you know, 1974 forward, that's to this day, that's still very rare. I mean, you're not becoming a, you know, par for the course, I would say. You're not rising up the ranks, you know, until you're in your 40s or 50s.
Right.
And he was rising at 18, 19.
And that was something that, as you said, right when he got out of high school, he had been putting in work. He was going up to Yardville. He was taking messages back. He was basically the conduit between Nikki Scarfo and the streets. And
he was actually taking Bruno's wife, mm-hmm. Like up there, like was in charge of maintenancing Angelo's family. So it was like, for a 19-year-old kid, he was getting a lot of responsibility, and he was showing them that he was capable, because he was handling it. Angelo's wife loved Philip, and, you know, in addition to bringing all the soldiers and capos that needed to talk to the bosses, he was also bringing the wife up there on a regular basis.
Nikki would get out. Angelo would get out. By 1976, this is where the big time starts to come for Nikki Scarfo. Fortunes change. On November 2nd, 1976, Atlantic City legalizes casino gambling, and the boom begins. And that's where we'll kind of get into the construction company, Scarf Inc. But Atlantic City had obviously all sorts of unions at this point. And one of the powerhouse unions was Local 54, hotel employees and restaurant workers, which is a huge union. Scarfo had a long-time relationship with a guy, Frank Gerais, who was the president of the union. And basically, Scarfo turns Local 54 into a big-time cash cow, starts getting all these payments every month, and he kind of heads that union. And that's when they kind of create Scarf Inc. Scarf Inc. was a concrete company that, you know, Philip and Nikki create, and they start doing all the concrete work at all the casinos. The first six casinos in Atlantic City, Scarf Inc. was doing the concrete for. So again, I mean, at some point, and I'm sure you could answer this, I'm sure at some point Nikki's dealing with Donald Trump. He's dealing with big time developers down in Atlantic City, Scott.
Yeah, I'll tell you that Donald Trump was doing quite a bit of business with both the Philadelphia mob, not in terms of illegal activity, I want people to understand that, but in terms of contracting for real estate construction and some of the properties he was building and developing, especially in Atlantic City. He was dealing with the Philly guys, as well as the Genovese crime family and the Gambino crime family out of New York, where he was, all of his trades were being controlled by organized crime. Now,
which again, Scott, it's important to mention that was normal back then,
right? I was about to say. So just to give people context so they understand, at that time period, you couldn't be a builder or developer on the East Coast, especially based out of New York City, without the bulk of your trades being mob controlled. I mean, it just, it wasn't possible.
Sure. And that's, you know, important to understand. We heard that during Trump's presidency. Oh, he used to mess with mob guys. Well, everybody did.
Right.
So again, the casino boom starts, casinos start being built across the boardwalk. It was a great time. Atlantic City was now a destination again. But back into organized crime in 1977, old Joe Rignetta dies. Anthony Caponegro becomes consigliere, and that becomes important because Caponegro becomes a very important figure in Philadelphia mob history around 1980.
Probably the, but not probably, I would say definitely, worst decision that Angelo Bruno made was tapping Tony Bananas as his consigliere. I think thinking that, here's what was going on at that point. Bruno had lost all, pretty much, he had, was out of touch with his rank and file. He was isolated and, you know, had his inner circle and didn't really have a desire to interact with his men. Tony Bananas was someone that was a street guy and was a guy that enjoyed being on the street and enjoyed interacting with the rank and file and controlled, you know, a big chunk of territory in Jersey, and was ambitious. And I think Bruno saw him as being a conduit to
the young guys,
the blue collar guys, even, you know, Nicky Carmondi is, you know, you mentioned him, Nicky Crow. He was kind of in that camp, you know, being a conduit to the blue collar guys and keeping those guys happy. In reality, he was just empowering Caponegro to put together a coup.
And the problem that Bruno had at this point as well is, as you said, he was falling out of touch, and he was also contradicting himself in many ways.
Yeah.
He was basically saying, you you folks in Philadelphia cannot sell drugs directly, but I'm going to take drug money from the Cherry Hill Gambinos, and I'm going to
and Long John.
Yeah, and I'm not going to, you know, there was a group called the Riccabinis. They were a faction mm-hmm. that was running around in Philadelphia. He wasn't taxing them. He basically didn't want to kind of ruffle any feathers, and he was just happy.
He wasn't taxing them because they were giving him a huge chunk of change every Christmas.
Right, but again, right. No one else saw any of that. And,
right,
and
right, right.
I think yeah. I think he started to ostracize his people. Now, again, Caponegro kind of, in a way, he was kind of similar to kind of John Gotti's rise in a way. I mean, he was growing sick and tired of the greedy boss that, you know.
He didn't pull it. Gotti pulled it off. He didn't pull it off.
Right. The problem, well, he did. In 1980, let's just real quick point this out. We'll get to 1980 and what happens to Angelo Bruno. But we mentioned the Scarf Inc., the concrete company that they were running down Atlantic City. By that time, they were tied up in Scarf Inc. And there was a guy, Vincent Falcone, who began to start talking shit about Scarfo and that they did shitty work and all this sort of thing. And he was trying to kind of muscle in, I guess you could say. And Nicky Scarfo, as we know.
He was quote unquote friends with these guys. You know, they were socializing together.
But I think behind the scenes, he was probably saying things, right?
No, he was. No, that's what I'm saying. So they're hanging around. They're doing business together, and then you know when Nicky would be gone or Philip would be gone, Falcone would then start spewing shit talk to the people that were at the bar or at the restaurant, and like you said, was telling everybody that Scarf Inc. does horrible work and shoddy work, and you know you shouldn't use them.
Now Scarfo gets wind of this, and weirdly enough, Vincent Falcone willingly, I guess, because again, he assumed they were friends. He didn't know that they were talking. You know, they didn't.
He didn't know that word had gotten back.
Sure,
that he had been bad. Down talking them.
They decide to go to this home in Margate, which is right outside of Atlantic City, and they're at a house. They're having some drinks, and Vincent Falcone turns his back. Philip Leonetti takes out a pistol and shoots Falcone in the back of the head while Scarfo basically calls him a cocksucker and a no good motherfucker. Keep in mind, there were some other folks there as well. One of the Merlinos was there and a guy called Joe Salerno, who was mm-hmm. a plumbing contractor. They dispose of the body. Falcone's body's discovered a few days later in a trunk of a car. The problem was, they had a witness in all this. Joe Salerno was not a mob guy. He was just a friend. He goes right to the FBI, basically, or to the police and says, hey, I saw what happened here. Wildly enough in this story, all of them get bail, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Usually you don't get bail on murder. They get bail, and then the trial takes place later, which we'll get to. In 1980, though, this is where the whole thing kind of gets crazy. Angelo Bruno, the boss of the family, is at Dante and Luigi's. He's having dinner. Or no, he's at Cousins Little Italy. I'm sorry. A restaurant in South Philly. He's
Which became Virgilio's, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
He's driving home. John Stanfa is the driver of the car, who at the time was just a driver. They pull up to Bruno's house, which is still there, 10th and Snyder, right in South Philly. And a gunman comes up to the back of Bruno and basically double barrel shotgun, back of the head. And you'll see the picture. It's floated around on the internet to this day. Basically, Bruno's mouth wide open as he sits there. Now, keep in mind, right before this happens, Stanfa rolls the window down. So you have to wonder, was Stanfa ever involved in this? We'll never know. I think we can all agree he was.
Let me tell you, he was. He was. I have no doubt in my mind that John Stanfa was part of the conspiracy to murder Angelo Bruno, and the only reason he survived the aftermath was because of his tie-ins to the Gambinos and the Cherry Hill group.
Now, obviously, there was a lot of issue with the family. The family was sick and tired of Bruno's stance, but the five families were absolutely furious about this. Giganti, a lot of others, they basically, this hit was not sanctioned by us. Right. Angelo Bruno was pretty powerful, too, at the time.
Angelo Bruno sat on the commission. He was very close to all of the New York dons. Caponegro was con, basically, and wanted to believe what he was being told, but shouldn't have. He was convinced by Funzie Thierry, who was a front boss for Gigante, Frank Thierry, who they all called Funzie, that it was sanctioned. So he pulled that off with the belief that the commission was behind him.
Right.
When in fact, Thierry just wanted Bruno out of the picture and Testa and Scarfo in the picture because of what's going on in Atlantic City. So let me just back up 1 second and then I'll take us forward. But I just want to say that the two big things that people had problems with related to Bruno was A, the hypocrisy that was coming out of his mouth when it came to drugs, telling everyone that, you know, they couldn't deal, or, you know, the whole deal or die mandate, when in reality, he was getting rich on drug money. And then the other side of the other issue was, and this ties into the assassination and Thierry and all those guys, and even in some ways the Falcone hit, that the other thing was, he wasn't, as much as everyone was excited about the casino boom in AC, Bruno wasn't. Bruno saw it as unwanted heat. But, you know, so Bruno was kind of slow on the trigger to really embrace what was going on in Atlantic City, and was telling people to keep their heads low. And it's like, yeah, keep your heads low in one regard, but in another regard, it's like, it's open season there. We can't not go take our piece of it. If we don't take our piece of it, all the New York families are going to come in and take their piece of it. So it became a situation where, you know, Thierry wanted Bruno out of the way because he wanted to get in there with the Philly guys to get a foothold in the casino industry, more so than they already were, because they felt Bruno was slow rolling it.
So Caponegro basically he basically understands that, you know, he has the backing, even though he didn't. He kills.
People should know also that Testa. We haven't mentioned him. Phil Testa, the Chicken Man, was Angelo Bruno's underboss.
Yep.
Nicky Scarfo's best friend, and Nicky Scarfo's two best friends were Chucky Merlino and Phil Testa, and Testa was taking the pulse of the capos in the years leading up to the Caponegro-led coup. Testa was taking the pulse of the family and considering a coup himself. So there was a lot of people unhappy with Angelo Bruno. And one of the best anecdotes, I want to give you two anecdotes of things I've heard firsthand that related to things we've just talked about in the last couple minutes. First is, I think the Vincent Falcone murder really is a microcosm of the lunacy and the egomaniacal bloodlust that Nicky Scarfo represented, and how killing was borderline sexual for him. And I'm not using that term lightly. Like, he got off on it. And the Falcone murder was a situation where, like you said, they lure Falcone to this house, and Philip has a gun stashed in the freezer of the house. And they say, Vince, I'm going to grab you a drink, and I'm going to go get some ice out of the freezer for the drink. And instead of grabbing the ice, he grabs the gun and puts two in the back of Falcone's head. And Nicky Scarfo at that point stands over the body and says, God, I love this. I love this so much. I wish I could bring this guy back to life to kill him again.
Yeah.
And then as the cleanup crew is doing their duty, they had to go get some stuff, I think, to dispose of the body. So from what I heard from people that were present, Nicky was left alone with the corpse for like an hour. And when they got back to load the body in the trunk, he was drunk and walking around the apartment with a bottle of Jack, and he's cutting water and double fisting, and was so happy, was so thrilled with his work, he had to get drunk with the body. And then the other thing I wanted to say was the response of Testa and Nikki Scarfo to those photos that you referenced of Angelo Bruno with his head blown off and his mouth agape was from talking to Philip. He said, that night when those pictures were being splashed on the television screen around the world and on headlines on newspapers around the country, he said that both Nikki Scarfo and Philip were like, that's so appropriate that his mouth would be up, because all the guy wanted to do was eat off other people's plates. He always had his mouth open.
Fascinating. Yeah, that's something I never knew. That would make sense. And yeah, they have to feel like they succeeded, because everything kind of went the way they wanted to. Bruno was dead. Caponegro would be murdered days later by New York people. He was discovered in the Bronx with two in his body, basically, and he actually had money stuffed up his backside. Yeah.
Yeah.
With the intention that he was greedy. By that point, as you said, the commission promote Phil Testa to be the boss of Philadelphia. Testa promotes a scarf for the consigliere, and a guy, old school guy, Peter Casella, to underboss. And at that point, though indicted for murder, they still get made. The books are opened for Phil Leonetti, Sal Testa, who was Philip's son, and then Wayne Grandy, Sal right. Merlino, and Chucky Merlino were all made official members. So everything was open.
That's something that people should know also, that Bruno was hesitant to build up the ranks of the family. Right. And as a result, attrition was taking its toll and the family was shrinking in size. And a lot of people, Testa, Scarfo, and the ilk thought that this was weakening their power and standing, in the East Coast underworld. And Bruno just really refused to make people. I think he only had one or two making ceremonies in his last dozen, 15, I think he was in power for 21 years. And I think he did a handful of making ceremonies right off the bat. In the early 60s, and then they closed the books. I think there might have been one that was conducted in the early 70s where Chicky Changolini and Chicky Narducci and Chicky Changolini and Frank Sindone got made. But no young blood was being flushed into the family. So the second that he died, books got opened up, and over the next 2-3 years, they inducted 25 guys.
Yeah, and everything was open. People started defecting out of the Bruno ranks and either got with it or, basically got down or laid down, basically.
Yeah.
Around this time as well, a guy, John McCullough, who was the president of the Roofers Union of Philadelphia, started trying to infringe on Scarfo's kind of things that were going on in Atlantic City. Scarfo asked to kill McCullough.
McCullough was tied into the so-called Irish mob in the
K&A group. Yep. A hitman goes to his house posing as a delivery man of flowers. He's invited in and basically is shot as his home. In 1981, Philip Testa is actually killed. And this was kind of a crazy hit. If you've ever listened to some of Bruce Springsteen, you'll hear about the Chicken Man being killed in Philly tonight. That was a reference to Philip Testa, who was called the Chicken Man. Basically, I think it was intended to look like it was from John McCullough's people, though, even though it wasn't.
Yeah,
it was actually from a guy, the guy Peter Casella, who was trying to become boss himself. He creates a nail bomb. They create a nail bomb, put it under Testa's porch. Testa lived in a neighborhood called Girard Estate, which to this day is a really nice neighborhood. It's one of the nice neighborhoods of Philadelphia. It's right around the Girard Estate, right over by Passyunk Avenue, over by the shopping centers now. It was a really beautiful house. It's still there today, 2117 Porter Street. He walks into his house, and at that point, there's a remote-controlled detonator across the street. A guy, Rocco Marinucci, presses the button. chicken and test is blown up and dies. Days later find out that Peter Casella was the one that orchestrated this hit. Crazy enough, he's given a pass and shelved. Yep. They basically tell him to get lost. You're out. You're done. And Nicky Scarfo takes over the family at that point.
Well, so Casella, it wasn't just Casella. So Casella went and aligned with two pretty powerful capos, the Barracuda, Frank Sindone,
yep,
also known as the Raccoon, and Frank Chicky Narducci, who
were both killed as well.
So to your point, Casella gets the pass, kind of like with John Stanfa. He was very closely aligned with the Gambinos, and I guess Castellano or some of the administration that were close to Carlo Gambino, who at that point had been dead for 4 years, but you know his cousins were still very powerful in Cherry Hill and were in the drug business with Casella. Got him a pass. He just had to leave town and go down to Florida. But Chicky Narducci and Frank Sindone were purged, as well as Rocco Marinucci. And Scarfo takes over and names Philip a capo, names Salvi Testa a capo, and gives Salvi Testa, who was his godson and was someone that, you know, Phil Testa and Nicky Scarfo were very close. And, you know, when they would speak in private, Testa had agreed that if anything ever happened to Nicky, that Testa would take care of Philip. And Nicky had agreed if anything ever happened to Phil, he would take care of Salvi. And Salvi wasn't just made a capo, but he was also assigned the murder contracts of his father's killers. And, mm-hmm. you know, eagerly went about carrying them out over the next year. And with Marinucci, you know, they killed him and then put firecrackers in his mouth, yep. to symbolize the fact that he had been the one that had pressed the button to blow up Phil Testa. And then with Narducci, I know that Salvi was telling people, you know, I got to be the trigger man and I got to get up close. I want to look him in his eye and pretty much, you know, tell him goodbye myself. It was very personal. And Salvi did it with a lot of relish.
And by that point, he had become kind of an accomplished hitman. It was his father. Yep. He wanted to feel it, and he definitely did. You also mentioned he becomes a capo. Same with Philip Leonetti.
And he had the charisma that his dad didn't have. Yes. I mean, people liked and respected Phil Testa, but Testa wasn't someone who would command a room. You know, sure. Salvi was an powerhouse.
Sure. Very much an up-and-comer, as you said. He also elevates Frank Monti to consigliere and Salvatore Merlino to underboss. So he was kind of creating everything. He was the boss now. And this is kind of where the floodgates open. I mean, mm-hmm. Scarfo starts installing things that were not really necessarily being installed during Bruno's time. He installs a street tax, which yep. was being paid. Any criminal working independent from the mob, whether it was a drug dealer, a bookmaker, a pimp, numbers, whoever, you paid a street tax weekly. And again, if you didn't pay, if you didn't get down or lay down, you were laid down. The money was then divided between the guys collecting the tax who got 98% and their capos or boss as well. So everybody got a piece. And if you didn't play ball, you were murdered. So people like, Steve Boris, who was running the Greek mob at the time, you know, Harry Riccobini, all these different guys. If you didn't pay, and look, as the mob would do, if you didn't pay, you died. And that's something that Nicky Scarfo, antithesized. If you didn't get involved, you were gone.
It's the opposite of Bruno. This was cowboy style to the tilt. Nicky loved gangster movies. He loved cowboys and Indians. He loved, you know, in your face mob activity. He loved, bodies strewn on the street and what that would do to, you know, his rivals, in the sense that, you know, announcing his presence with authority. He came in and in the next 5 years, he ordered 30 murders in a city and in a mob family that hadn't had 30 murders in the past 30 years.
Yep.
And he ordered 30 in 5 years. And like you said, you know, the JBM, Junior Black Mafia there popularized the phrase, get down or lay down, but, you know, Nicky embodied it, with his regime. And it was, yeah, you know, just controlling all vice on the street, not cherry picking the way that Bruno did, getting even more involved in unions, making alliances with the bikers and the blacks, and, you know, seizing power over the Greeks, like you said, Stevie Boris and Harry Pappas, who was one of, I believe it was Harry Petros, I believe. There was two Greek mob bosses killed in the same week. Boris and Petros were killed in the same week in 1982 or 83. And, you know, it was a new day. And what's interesting, and then I'll turn it back over to you to keep the narrative flowing, but what's interesting to me is that at that point, in 1981, and we should also say that Harry Riccobini, there's another war that breaks out with Harry Riccobini and the Riccobini faction, that won't fall in line under Scarfo. And Scarfo gives, you know, the okay for Salvi Testa at that point. Okay, he said, you know, you just led a war against your father's killers. Now you're going to lead the war against the Riccobini faction. And Salvi and his crew went out there and you know, took it to the streets with Riccobini's and ended up winning that war. So he just really, Salvi had really, you know, he had shed skin for the family. He was shot in that war against the Riccobini's, survived an assassination attempt, and just was really very loyal to Nicky Scarfo. And that was representative of the whole family at that point. Nicky had so much potential in terms of becoming a great La Cosa Nostra leader, because he had a ton of support from both the OG contingent, the old school guys that had been under Bruno and had been dissatisfied, came underneath him. The guys that were underneath Caponegro in the failed coup came underneath him. The guys that, you know, weren't purged. And then all the younger guys, which there was a ton of them, guys that were nephews and sons and cousins of Scarfo's inner circle. So, I mean, he had so much potential for building something that could have been really, really unbreakable. And it slowly eroded because of him becoming paranoid and yep, power drunk. And, you know, he was already violence prone. So you put those three things together, it was a dangerous recipe. And within 3 years, what could have been this regal, flourishing mob empire was coming apart at the seams, because everyone thought that Scarfo was going to put a contract on their head.
Yeah. And by this time, as you said, I mean, they were making a ton of money, but, you know, Nicky had, I mean, it was the Wild West in South Philly. I mean, everybody was getting killed.
He lost his mind. I mean, he literally lost his mind.
Yep. Like, no, you're totally
right. He was irrational and, you know, just was not rooted in reality. And there was zero checks, because at that point, New York was in full support of him. So he would like I talked about earlier, where, you know, he would hold court and at these restaurants and at these bars and clubs. And at first it was very chummy and benign when these sessions kind of started in the late 70s, early 80s. But by the mid 80s, by 83, 84, 85, he would stand up in front of 20 guys at the table and be like, if you guys don't start, you know, toeing the line and acting right, I'm going to bring in a hit crew from New York. I'm going to kill every one of you.
Yeah,
I'm going to kill this whole. He was threatening to kill the entire family and start from scratch.
Yeah, he was a real lunatic. For
sure. Yeah, and he was voicing this to the rank and file.
It wasn't something that like he was confiding in his consigliere, you know, in the dark of night in the back of a, you know, back office room. He's announcing this to his entire family that if you don't start acting right or doing what I say better, I'm going to kill. I'm going to genocide our whole family.
Yeah, he really became a lunatic and even became enraged one time when the media dubbed the organization the gang that couldn't shoot straight because they were shooting so many people that, you know, bullets were going all over the place. They're riddling bullets. They were going after people and they weren't there. There was all sorts of things going on. It was really a mess down in South Philly in the '80s. And yeah, at one point, Nikki goes to jail in 1982, comes out and nephew Philip Leonetti is there waiting for him. He spent the day partying at a hotel and then he flew down
as a Salvi. As a Salvi.
Yep. They fly down to, Atlantic City. And that's where Nikki's kind of at the height of his power. They're making a ton of money. But this is where, and as you said, this is where the paranoia starts for Nikki Scarfield. Really, it had always been happening, but he becomes to see that Sal Testa is being written about. He's making a ton of money. He went to war for the family and survived. He was charismatic. He was confident. He was loyal and popular. And he starts to get kind of everything that he had deserved. Sal Testa was a mob guy through and through, and he was liked by a lot of people. And little Nikki Scarfo started seeing that. He also was in a relationship at that point with Chucky Merlino's kid, Maria Merlino. And you know, they get engaged. Testa then breaks off the engagement. I guess he gets cold feet.
This was April. So this was April of 84. Nikki gets out of prison in
84.
January or February of 84. There's that famous news footage of him landing in the airport and being chauffeured or flanked, if you will, by his nephew Philip and Salvi. Salvi's wearing a cowboy hat that he had got down in Texas because that's where they went and picked up Nikki from. And fast forward 2 months to April, and Salvi Testa breaks off the engagement with Maria Merlino.
And that really kind of enrages Nikki Scarfo, as did other things.
Well, I think he used it as an excuse. I don't think he really gave it. I think Chucky Merlino gave a shit because he was embarrassed.
Right, and he used it as an excuse that Testa had to go at that point. Right. I think you're totally right. Now, again, Testa was, you know, a guy you want around. He was a growing – he really made you into what you were, I think, in a way.
And he loved Nikki. He loved Nikki. There was no from everyone I've spoken to, and I've spoken to probably a dozen people that knew Salvi on a firsthand basis. Probably a half dozen of those guys, I would say, were in Salvi's inner circle. And they all say to a T, Salvi loved Nikki. Salvi loved everything Nikki was about. There was no way, shape, or form in any universe where Salvi Testa would have turned on Nikki and tried to undermine Nikki. All he wanted to do was serve Nikki and be loyal to Nikki. And because, like you said, he started to get some attention from the press. And I mean, look at the guy was good looking. Yep. He was, like you said, he was magnetic and he was the holy, I call it the holy trinity in organized crime circles. And this is organized crime. If you're Italian, Jewish, Irish, Black, Mexican, the holy trinity, loved, feared, respected. And it's hard to get all those three.
The crazy thing about Nikki Scarfo, and I just want to kind of interject. The crazy thing about Nikki Scarfo is if he'd have just played by the rules, Sal Testa would have waited on him hand and foot. He would have played the game the right way. Nikki would have went deep into his life. He was the boss, you know, made a ton of money. He would pass away and you know, Testa would probably take over as long as, you know,
Testa and Leonetti would have taken over but then the murder of Testa, I think, was the final straw for everybody, including Leonetti.
Yeah. Right.
And you hear the story about Leonetti, you know, saying something about there are some people that question Philip's sincerity when he says that he was upset by Salvi's murder because there was a conversation that was relayed by Nikki Crow
in his book where Philip allegedly said, you know, can we just kill this guy already? I'm sick of seeing his face. And I think that was totally taken out of context. And I'm not, you know, I'm not denying he might have said something like that, but I don't think it was like, I'm tired of seeing his face. I can't stand this guy. It was more like, my uncle is making us kill this guy. I love this guy. I can't believe we're doing this, but we have to do it. So let's just get it over with.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. And that kind of was at the point in April, Scarfo made his mind up and unwilling to listen to reason, he decides that Sal Testa has to go. The problem that they would have in this hit was Sal Testa was a hitman himself. He knew kind of the tricks of how it all worked, and he was cautious. He wasn't gonna, you know, just show up somewhere like Vincent Falcone would. It was gonna be difficult. And Nicky Scarfo assigned kind of the best people to do it. He assigns Nicky Caramonte and a guy named Charles Iannucci to the hit. But Charlie, he would need White, other people
R.I.P.,
as well.
R.I.P. Charlie White.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he would need other people though as well, and he would need friends of Testa to help out. Joey Pungitore was involved. Salvatore Grandi was involved. Everyone was kind of involved, and they basically lure Salvi Testa to a store on South Street. And at that point, he turns to talk
to Joey Pungitore. It was a candy shop that they ran a book out of.
Yep. They're all in there. Salvi turns his back to Joey Punt to talk to Joey Punge, and Wayne Grandi takes a gun out and shoots him in the back of the head.
Punge was his best friend. Salvi and Joey Punge were as thick as thieves, and you know that if there's anything that can really paint a picture of how ruthless the mafia is and organized crime when we're talking about professional hits. And I think Henry Hill or the Henry Hill character in Goodfellas said it the best, you know, when they put a contract on your head, it's your best friend that's coming to carry it out. It ain't the scary boogeyman, you know, the boogeyman, you know, hitman that you don't know. It's the devil you do know. It's not the devil that you don't know. So, you know, Joey Punge was put in a situation where he had to whack out his best friend.
Yeah. And you know, you always kind of wonder, I've always wondered this, you know, maybe if, you know, and I'll ask you, because you know Philip Leonetti pretty well. He wrote his book. If at this point, if Salvi Testa and Joey Punge and all these young guys, let's say they go to Philip and say, do you ever think Philip at that point would say, you know what, you're out of hand, Nicky. You're my uncle, but you know, you got to go.
No, I think that's where things were trending. I think that if the indictment hadn't have dropped in, I believe it was March of 87, and everyone got picked up, I believe if there had been no arrests or indictments that spring, I believe by the summer of 87, Philip would have organized his own coup and would have killed his uncle, and maybe even had retired and handed the reins to someone else. Because at that point, Philip was very jaded and really didn't want to be a part of organized crime anymore. But yeah, I don't think there's any way that if things had been going in the direction that they were going in, that Scarfo would have survived in terms of a revolution. There would have been a revolt. And Philip told me this himself, like, I was planning on killing my uncle.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone will blame him. Kill Salvi Testa.
But you give an interesting scenario there. I don't, and I, maybe this did happen, I don't know. It would be interesting to if you could play that, you know, what if history game.
Yeah.
If Salvi, that summer of 84, where he knew that there had been a contract in his head, and you know, they stalked him that whole summer. They weren't able to get him until September. If Salvi would have gone to Philip and been like, hey man, let's join forces and get rid of your crazy fucking uncle.
You gotta wonder.
Take this thing over ourselves. And what Philip's, I part of me thinks Philip would have been on board with it.
I agree. And I feel like, as you said, I think Philip had become kind of jaded with the life at any rate and said, look, I'm done with this. You know, you do what you have to do. I'm out. I'm gonna shelve myself. You could take over. And you got to wonder where the family would have went, because I think at that point, you know, John Stanford would have never came across. Who knows what would happen? But it is a fascinating question. They dump Salvi's remains on a dirt road in Gloucester Township, New Jersey, and by that point, you know, they do away with him. He's done. That same year, Nikki and Phil Leonetti did all sorts of things. They were still making money. They were still doing things. Philip and Nikki were spending a lot of time down in Florida and Atlantic City. By 1985, Scarfa becomes a target. Look, he had been a target, but he was a target of the New Jersey State Police in a major gambling investigation. Nikki never talked business on the phone, so the wiretaps weren't really used. But, you know, again, there were still murders going on. There were all sorts of things going on. By 1985, though, and this is where kind of it gets really bad for Nikki Scarfo, Nikki plots to basically, there's a contract in Penn's Landing in Philadelphia. The city wanted to revive the waterfront, and a commercial developer, Willard Rouse, basically wants the contract. He wants to make the Penn's Landing a tourist spot, and ends it up today. It is a beautiful place to go. Nikki sends Nick Caramondi to go speak to Willard Rouse. He offers him $1 million. He basically asks for $1 million to fix the bid for Rouse. Rouse gets spooked and contacts the FBI. And at that point, the FBI sends in an undercover agent, and they get Nikki Caramondi jammed up in this whole thing. He's indicted for his role in an extortion case in 1986. And by that point, the thread is ending on Nikki Scarfo. That was kind of the end, right?
Yeah. So when Nikki Crow and Tommy Dell flipped, that was really all she wrote. Those were two mob capos that were, you know, helping run, if not running, Philadelphia. You got to remember that Nikki was, during his reign, was still based out of Atlantic City, and Chucky Merlino, who was his best friend and underboss, was the, you know, for all intents and purposes, was the street boss and was in charge of Philadelphia. Chucky and Nikki had a falling out in 86, the end of 85, 86. Chucky Merlino had become he was drinking a lot and getting out of control with some of his behavior while he was drinking. I think he had a DUI where he tried to bribe a police officer. He had a run-in with the Pagans where he, you know, took his Mercedes and rammed it into a bunch of Pagans' motorcycles when he was drunk. And Nikki shelved Chucky, and that's when he promoted Leonetti to underboss. But Leonetti was with Nikki in Atlantic City. So at that point, Philadelphia was under the auspice of or under the control of Tommy Dell, Fancy Signer, Fanny, Faffy Einarella, and Nikki Crow, and Charlie White. So those four guys were running Philly, and two of them flipped. You know, so it's a wrap, man. They could attest to all of the bribery, all of the shakedowns, all of the murders. So Tommy Dell and Nikki Crow flipped. Charlie White and Faffy went down with the ship. Charlie and Faffy both got out of prison in the last 10, 15 years. Charlie White just died. Faffy is back in the mix, and, you know, depending on who you talk to, is either, you know, involved or retired.
Yeah. And as you said, in 1986, around that time, Caramani's indicted, everybody's indicted. And, you know, that's the end for Nikki Scarfo. Between 87 and 89, Scarfo was convicted three different times for conspiracy, racketeering, murder, and was sentenced initially to 14 years. Then he got 55 years. Then he got life, although the life sentence was later overturned. And he had to thank people like Nick Caramondi, who was kind of the integral part of all that.
Tommy Dell and Nikki Crow were the star witnesses.
Correct. And Nikki was convicted in the Court of Common Pleas in 1989 for the first degree murder of Frank Frankie Flowers de Alfonso, who was actually killed on 12th and Shunk, I believe. He was also with six of his lieutenants. They all tested it against him, whether it was Gino Milano, whether it was Lawrence Molino, whether it was, Caramondi. They all testified against him.
Yeah. So, yeah, Yogi Merlino ended up jumping ship. That was Chucky Merlino's brother, Lawrence Merlino. They call Yogi. And, he had a lot of people taking the witness stand at that point. Gino Milano ended up flipping. And what's interesting about that is that case ended up taking down Phil Narducci, Chicky Narducci's son, and Uncle Joe Legambi, who, according to the federal government, was the day-to-day acting boss of the Philadelphia Mob for 20 years, from around 2000 to around 2020, and they were convicted in that hit, Legambi as a shooter. Mm-hmm. But then fast forward almost a decade later, the case got tossed, and there was a retrial, and they were acquitted of it. So both Narducci and Legambi, get a second lease on life, and have been out of prison, and are still out of prison.
Now, by 89, Scarfa, 60 years old, a 55-year sentence is basically life in prison. He would still attempt to run the family in prison. In 1989, this is where you can comment. Philip Leonetti decides in 1989 to testify as well to avoid a 45-year prison sentence and basically spill his guts, which you know intimately.
Yeah. And it wasn't just Nikki. It was, Gotti as well.
Yep, sure, exactly. Philip Leonetti was, from what people say, was a star witness. And he has detailed that in Scott's book, Mafia Prince. Also, though, some cautionary tales. During the trial, Nikki Scarfa had several sons. One of his sons, Mark, attempted suicide during the trial. Mark, at that point, was 17 years old. He was getting a lot of bullying, taunting in school. He, according to people, Nikki wanted him to go into the life, and the kid didn't want to. The kid wanted to do other things, and he was very despondent over the possible imprisonment and all that kind of stuff. He attempts to hang himself in 1988 at 17. He suffers cardiac arrest and deprived of oxygen. And until 2014, he lived in a coma. He was in a coma.
Yep.
He died in 2014. And it was really kind of, we don't ever really talk about the people involved in the mob that aren't involved in the mob, people like Mark
people
Scarfo.
That are, ripple effects to the people that are connected to the people, family-wise and friendship-wise, and that are connected to the people that are in the mob, and especially when you're talking about families. I mean, I see it every day in my reporting, interacting with family members of both victims, family members, and, mob figures, family members, the accused, if you will, or the convicted. And, you don't get to pick who your parents are.
No,
you don't get to pick who your uncle is or who your grandfather is. And, I can talk a little bit from, a little bit of personal experience. My great uncle was via marriage was murdered, in a Detroit mob hit in 1971. I never got to meet him, but I obviously heard a lot of stories about that. And my my grandfather was I wouldn't say he was a mobster, but I would say he was a mob associate, a Jewish gambler that hung around with all of the big time Jewish wise guys in Detroit. And these guys were just my grandpa's buddies. But then you realize that some of these guys are suspected murderers or, suspected of pretty vile things. And then, you think about those people that and their daughters and their sons, and they have to read about the stuff in the paper, and they have to, live it. And it really has nothing, it has nothing to do with them other than the fact that that's who their relative is.
Yeah. And some people just try to kind of brush it under the carpet and just kind of try to live their own life. But some like Mark Scarfo, and look, even if you, you know, if you're familiar with like Roy DeMeo, he had a son, Albert DeMeo, and he wrote a book about his life and how, you know, his whole life he's had to live with the fact of what his father did. And yeah, a lot of, there's a lot of cautionary tales that, you know, there are usually when your father or uncle's in the mob or whoever, people just kind of assume because they did it, you're going to do it. And, you know, if you look at Nicky's son, Nicky Jr., I mean, he went into the mob and he went into that kind of life and he's currently in prison. But Nicky is a lunatic. And I kind of want to end it with kind of my thoughts on Nicky, but real quick, Nicky served his sentence at USP Atlanta. He was then transferred to FMC Butner in North Carolina, where he died of natural causes in 2017. Nicky tried to beat it out. He died he was very old. I think he was 87 when he died.
Yeah.
Lived pretty long and had a wild life.
Can I add two postscripts to the analysis of Nicky Scarfo real quick?
I want you to share, if you can. Can you share the story about Nicky's reaction about your book?
So there's two things I want to tell listeners. That one thing I'm sure they don't know, and one thing they might not know, or they might know. First is, you know, Nicky, like we talked about, Salvi being La Cosa Nostra through and through, to, you know, at the cellular level. So was Nicky Scarfo. Even though he was locked up the last 30 years of his life, he was someone that was still trying to be involved as much as he could with La Cosa Nostra, and was intent on reclaiming the Philadelphia mob family, like up until 10 years ago, like into the 2000s and 2010s. His son, Nicky Jr., ended up getting busted in this big bank scam, and they ended up ripping this bank off for, I don't know the numbers, but, you know, millions of dollars. And if you read the court documents, Nicky was intending on taking the money from this scam and buying his way back to the top of the Philadelphia mob by giving this money to the Lucchese family in New York and arranging for the current mob players in Philadelphia to be murdered. And then he was going to install his son as the boss, and he was going to be running the show from in prison. I mean, that's how unrooted from reality Nicky Scarfo was in the last years of his life, that he's living this alternative universe where he could have somehow pulled that off, which again speaks to what a lunatic
Nicky was. And I think if, you know, obviously by listening to this and going into everything, Nicky was a lunatic. He was a psychopath. He was one of the biggest nuts in the history of organized crime. And I want to quickly, you told me a story about when Nicky and you connected this to, you know, you got info straight from the prison about this,
right?
About when Nicky, and let's keep in mind, once Nicky found out that Philip Leonetti's snitch, and to this day Philip Leonetti doesn't show his face, he's still worried about it. What did he do when he found out about this book?
First, Nicky found out that Philip was writing the book, and we knew that he was upset by that. Philip had considered writing the book in the 1990s, right after he flipped with George Anastasia, and then just the project fizzled. So book gets released. There was a big marketing push right off the bat with it. And in the front of the book, Philip dedicates the book to Nicky, but in an underhanded way, basically saying, you know, I want to dedicate this to you. You taught me all about the life and what it means. And, you know, look at you and look at me, pretty much saying, like, I didn't listen to you and I got out and I'm living my best life now. And you're stuck there for the rest of your life. You know, pretty much you're going to die buried underneath the prison. It was a real fuck you, frankly, to Scarfo. So Scarfo ordered the book in prison. He gets it sent to him. This was in fall of 2012, I believe. And he got it, and he was, I heard he was in the, either in the yard or in the
in the area where they congregate, where the television is, in the kind of rec area of the prison. And he looked at the book and he read the inscription and he had a heart attack. I mean, he literally had a heart attack.
Couldn't believe it.
Within 10 seconds of picking up my book.
He was absolutely incensed.
Was in the hospital in Butner for a good couple months recovering from that.
So you feel like you gave Nicky Scarfo a heart attack?
Yeah. I mean, I think me and Philip both think that just reading that inscription and, you know, you'd heard about the book, but actually getting the physical copy of the book in his hands with a picture of him and Philip on the cover and knowing that, or at least thinking in his mind that Philip was, you know, capitalizing off of this. And he was, but in terms of, you know, financials, I think that people have a very different idea of how much you get paid to write something like that. You know, people think you get a book in Barnes and Noble, you're rich, and that's not necessarily the case.
But I think you got to put that in your Twitter bio. Once gave Nicky Scarfo.
Once gave Nicky Scarfo a coronary.
But all in all, I think we always try to, you know, in our first episode, we always try to tie the episode back to normality. And look, at the end of the day, Nicky Scarfo was a lunatic. I think as we kind of uncovered in this show, if Nicky Scarfo had just played by the rules, which I think up until he became boss, he did.
Yep. Right. That's my point. When I said that he became paranoid and power drunk, he didn't really show, other than the fact that he had a hair trigger temper, and people knew that, and had a Napoleon complex. I mean, people knew
now,
that.
Now, would he
and
have
that
been...
he was that he, and that he was a killer? But the notion that he would go off the rails the way he went off the rails, there was really nothing in his history that would have led you to believe that, other than the one incident he had, you know, at the Oregon Diner. But I don't think that could have foreshadowed or gave anyone an inclination that when he would become boss, you know, he would become, for all intents and purposes, a serial killer.
Yeah, I don't think anyone thought it. And look, ultimately, you know, Salvi dies. Philip goes into the witness protection program.
Murder's a way of life. Murder's a way of life in the mob, but, you know, then that's a fact. But there are people that do it because it's business, and then there are people that do it for pleasure.
Just to do it, right.
And Nicky was doing it for pleasure, and that's what was so disturbing.
Yeah, he was a disturbing guy. Scott Bernstein, great stuff. Nicky, definitely not the greatest boss in the world, but definitely a fascinating guy nonetheless. By the way, you still talk to Philip Leonetti? What's he been up to?
You know, we're in contact. I mean, we're not – I'm not going to tell you that we're best friends, but I got nothing but respect for the guy. I owe him – you know, I owe him and George my, you know, a lot of my career, because they co-signed me. They validated me by letting me write his book. He allowed me, it was kind of like a punching my ticket to be able to write about Philadelphia after that. So, you know, Philip's incredibly intelligent, well-spoken. And the best thing I have to say about Philip, and I think this is how I want to end this episode. Or on my end, what I can say about Philip, and I can't say this about literally any other high ranking mob figure that I've ever been associated with. And I've literally sat down with dozens, including a handful of La Cosa Nostra bosses, you know, guys that were bosses of crime families. And Philip was obviously an underboss, and every single one of them, except for Philip, longs for their former life. And if you gave them a choice that they could go back and do it all over again, they'd do it in a second. And there's nothing about Philip that fits that mold. Philip is genuinely happy to be a regular schnook. And I use the line from Goodfellas where Henry Hill says, you know, I live like a nobody in a nobody town. When I ask for spaghetti and gravy, I get egg noodles and ketchup. I'm just a regular schnook. And Philip loves being a regular schnook. And I admire that in him, because he said, you know, he's like, recounting what he said to me. I love being able to just take my wife out for dinner and a movie and a walk. And take my kid out to the golf course for a round, and just be able to live a normal life. There's nothing about my former life that I want to recapture or relive. I like to be a normal guy living a normal, boring life. When, like, I'm telling you, the opposite of that would be Ralph Natale, who was the boss of Philadelphia in the 1990s, who I spent a good deal of time with. And, you know, Ralph, and I say this all due respect to Ralph, because I like Ralph, and Ralph has been really good to me, and I got nothing negative to say about Ralph on a personal level. But I will say that, you know, Ralph, you know, is a legend in his own mind, and Ralph wants to be Ralph Natale circa 1995, not Ralph Natale circa 2020. Gotcha. There's nothing about Philip that wants to be, quote unquote, crazy Phil Leonetti circa 1986.
According to Philip, he's at peace. I got to ask you real quick before we go. Yep. Do you believe that story? And I want to set the stage real quick. There's a story that was going around that Nicky one time went horseback riding. Yeah. And whether you believe it or not, he went horseback riding. And the horse, I guess, in his deranged lunatic personality, he got bucked off the horse, basically. And they were on some sort of like cliffside, and Nicky became so enraged that he pushed the horse off the hill. Do you believe that? Is that?
Yeah, I believe it.
Is that truthful?
Yes, I believe it is. I
mean, that kind of incenses who Nicky is.
That's how unhinged he was. And he was living on another planet. I mean, Philip told me about, this is when Philip was the underboss, and it'd be 3 o'clock in the morning, and Nicky would be calling him in the middle of the night to call plumber for him. And then the plumber didn't get there in time. So he called Philip and said, I'll cancel that plumber and hire another plumber. And it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And Philip's like, oh, well, what do you, why are you making me do this? I'm your underboss. Why are we having these conversations right now? And, you know, there's 1,000 other people that can do this. And he's like, well, you're the only one I trust.
Yeah.
And but it's like, that's the type of like
paranoia.
It's the kind of craziness that you're dealing with. And the one thing that another thing that really stuck out to me when Philip was talking about Nicky, and when Nicky would talk about how you keep power, you know, he would say, just kill, 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 just keep killing. I mean, he would vocalize this. He's like, that's the only way you keep power.
A total so just psychopath. Yeah. In every sense of the word.
It's a cautionary tale for what someone that wasn't necessarily a lunatic, not to say that he was of sound mind before this, but I don't think he was quite at the level of sociopathy that he reached, and you know how, you know, power can go to someone's head and become so detrimental that you become a cancer to society.
Yeah, a total lunatic in every sense of the word. Nicky Scarfo on the Sit Down. Scott Bernstein, great stuff. Very detailed as always. You can find Scott Bernstein on the Gangster Report at gangsterreport.com, a great website that keeps track of daily gangster news. You can also check out his book on Philip Leonetti and the Philadelphia Mob, Mafia Prince. You can get it on Amazon. It's a great book. And also, make sure you catch Scott on White Boy, which is currently live on Netflix, one of the great documentaries you'll find on there right now. In fact, could be the hottest documentary in the streets right now. Also, check Scott out on Twitter at B-U-R-N-E-Y-S, tweets, Bernsey's tweets. I'll tag
Bernie's,
that in
Bernie's tweets.
Bernie's tweets. Sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll make and sure then, we tag that.
And I also want to let everyone know that my podcast called the Original Gangsters Podcast, aka the OG, launched in 2009 on the CBS Intercom platform, which is now called Odyssey. We were named top 10 true crime podcasts by Time Magazine and Radio.com in 2019. Unfortunately, in 2020, we had to go dormant, and we've been sitting idle for about 8 months, and we're on the verge of relaunching. So watch for that Original Gangsters Podcast. Wherever you consume your podcasts, will be 10 fresh new. We had 25 episodes we did between 2019 and the first half of 2020. And we're going to come back, gangbusters here letting everyone know that the OG podcast hasn't gone anywhere. We got 10 fresh new episodes that will be dropping in the next couple weeks.
We'll look forward to it. Scott Bernstein, as always, great stuff. I always enjoy talking to you, and thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate it, buddy.
No problem. As always, you can find us on Twitter at the Sitdown 7. This has been the Sitdown. It's Nicky Scarfo. Next week, very good show as well. We're going to talk about the mafia cops, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa, two of the most corrupt people in law enforcement in the history of this country. We'll talk about them. Thanks, as always, to Scott Bernstein for coming on. I am Jeff Nadeau. We will see you next week here on the Sit Crime and Mafia.